You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Soon it was a dull roar, and suddenly she knew what it was. Water. Flowing water. Getting closer, she heard bubbling, splashing, and surging from rapidly coursing water. But it was more than that. Water was falling, cascading, and merging with another body of water. The floor became damp, and the source of the swelling sound was imminent. Drops splashed onto her feet, and she slowed her progress and told Manet to do the same, so they wouldn't step or slip into whatever water this was. Soon she was very glad she had. With her skin and clothing getting moist and the floor wet and slippery, her foot passed over the edge of a promontory, her forefoot unsupported, her heel on firm rock. She halted and was cautiously placing weight on her other foot when her backbone was struck by the forward-moving head of Manet. Deliani's shrill cry stopped the raven in her tracks. The Kirin wavered, trying desperately to maintain balance, but the forward impulse had been too great. Toppling over the brink, she plummeted headlong. Descending for what seemed an eternity, but was only moments, she struck a cold surface of water and went under. Deliani was an exceptional swimmer, her long, sinewy feet able to propel her powerfully through water. Thus, she turned herself around and rose quickly to the surface. It was choppy and wavy, and she was tossed about. Assuming the water to be moving, she thought she was being carried downstream, and from the clamor of the deluge, probably at a substantial speed. Yet she could feel little undertow or current. "The stream might be conveying me so smoothly," she thought, "that I can't detect it." She swam in the direction she assumed the wall to be, and found it, hard and slick. But the water was only lapping against it, the wall appearing stationary. Not moving past it as she would be if drawn by current, to her delight she wasn't moving at all. At least in this part of the stream, or whatever this might be, there was no current. Grateful for this good fortune, she clung to the clammy surface and called in Curlace to Manet above. "I am all right. I have fallen into water, but I am not harmed. You are a brave and faithful bird, but do not try to rescue me. Don't move. I must know where you are." Hardly certain Manet could hear her over the din, she was afraid the great bird would try to climb or fly down, which would almost certainly end in failure, and she might lose the eidolon. Feeling the wall, she found it sheer and featureless. She moved to her right and left, exploring, but did not want to stray far afield, fearing she would venture too far from the precipice and not find her way back. Kirins are skillful climbers, even of steep inclines. If they find toeholds, they can ascend vertical surfaces. Deliani might have been able to scale this wall except for two factors. It was slippery, and it wasn't perpendicular, angling toward her as it rose. Making many attempts to climb out of the water, she could locate nothing to grasp, even with her capable feet, and eventually stopped trying. "Manet," she called, fearful the bird would try to do something. "Stay where you are. I am all right." But she wasn't all right, and she knew it, having run out of ideas and out of energy. Treading water, head bobbing above the surface, she tried to think how the raven might help. All at once, something touched her forehead. She swept it away frantically with her hand, having no idea what it was. But it returned, brushing her cheek, and she batted it away. Hands walking along the wall, she moved to the side, then stopped and waited. The thing found her again, this time on her neck, and she swiped at it. Then it was in her hair, and she shook her head violently. Having felt it four times, she had an impression of what it was like. It seemed thin and pliable. The next time it found her, again on the cheek, She pawed at it, then grasped it with both hands, and found it was dry and not slippery. Feeling, tugging, and smelling it, having no idea how it got here, she knew what it was, a rope coming miraculously from above. Chapter 40. Holding the cord tightly, Deliani tested it, jerking it several times, then giving a strong, steady pull. As the rope seemed firmly anchored, she began hauling herself upward, but soon was amazed to find she was being drawn upward, hoisted out of the water by someone or something unknown. Clinging to the rope, she allowed her feet to walk up the wall as she was lifted powerfully aloft. Reaching the precipice, she was pulled up and over. When she stood beside a greatly relieved Manet, the rope slackened and dropped to the floor. "Who's there?" cried Deliani. "Who is it?" As she peered into utter darkness, no communication came from her unidentified benefactor. She released her end of the rope, and it too fell to the moist floor. She decided to search for any chance of help or hope of escape. Turning toward the water, she sensed that the flow was coming from her right. She felt her way in that direction to the rugged wall, then followed it with both hands and feet toward the brink. Most of the wall came to an end and turned a corner, while a low segment and the floor went on toward the water. With moisture spraying over her feet, she detected that this low segment was smooth and that it and the floor ended at the edge of the promontory. Following the low segment upward, she found that it ended and another surface ran away from it, parallel to the floor, this one also flat and smooth. These were hardly natural stone formations, and, recognizing what they were, she became excited. Everywhere in the Shillito cave, they were unknown to the clans at home. "They are stairs," she told herself, "hewn by the tools of Kirins who dwelled here. Stairs must lead somewhere, probably to the cave." To the right of the steps, a smooth wall extended as high as she could reach. With her hand on it, she placed her right foot on the first slab and stepped up. With her left foot, she investigated the outside edge. Beyond it, she sensed air, spray, and tumultuous water. Recalling the blow she had received, she put a hand above her head and ascended one step at a time. The stairway was saturated and slippery as she rose, step after step, in total darkness, her right hand touching the wall. The water's roar was constant and getting louder. Because of continuing foam, spray, and noise, she concluded she was beside an underground waterfall cascading into the pool below. Once, placing her left foot on a polished surface, it skidded and she lost her balance. She caught herself and clung to the wall, heart beating rapidly. Beginning the ascent anew, her hand soon encountered a rocky surface at the roof of this space, and she searched for a door, a latch, a hinge, or any opening, but found only cold, perspiring stone. Crouching, she felt the remaining few steps. They ended at the ceiling. It was a dead end. What kind of staircase would end in nothing, lead nowhere? Frustrated, almost angry, she began the descent with measured steps, counting 188 stairs, and was greeted by Manet at the bottom. "I must investigate the other side," she told the raven. "Kirins were here. I'm confident of that. We'll find our way out." Finding the opposite wall, she moved cautiously toward the precipice. This wall also turned a corner, but instead of stairs, a smooth extension of the floor formed a narrow ledge, sheer wall above, restless water below. "I hope it's a pathway," she thought, stirred by the possibility that Kirin hands had hewn it. Edging her way onto the slim shelf, she crept cautiously along, one foot in front of the other, hands against the wall. She had gone a substantial distance when the pathway began to slope downward, noise from the water becoming louder. At one point, as she placed a foot on the shelf, the surface shifted, the rock crumbled, and her only support was under the other foot. Clinging to the clammy wall, frightened, she imagined hearing fragments rain into the water below. Raising her front foot, she stepped carefully over the defect and found the shelf stable. Gradually, she shifted her weight. The ledge held, and she continued her slow progress. Soon, she saw something she couldn't believe was here, something she yearned for. Blinking, she turned away, then looked back. Ahead, how far she couldn't tell, was a pinpoint of light streaming through the blackness, a beacon almost blinding after an endless period in the dark. More than light, it was a ray of hope. She was jubilant and had to remind herself to be calm and deliberate and not move too quickly, but she couldn't restrain herself from such an instinctive urge as having light. The pathway broadened, and soon she was running, tripping over outcroppings of rock. She clambered over a ridge and stumbled up a mild ascent, the jewel of brightness growing. She took a last few steps and pressed her face against a hole in the rock large enough to accommodate an eye. The glare was blinding, and she turned and blinked it away. But starved for light, she looked back and slowly became accustomed to the brilliance. To her profound joy, it was what she had hoped to see, the Shillitoe Cave. Reveling in a panoramic view from on high, drinking in the scene's every detail, she spied a few Shillitoes in doorways and windows in the distant wall and strolling on the floor far below. "I'm here," she cried through the hole. "Deliani of the visiting party!" Going about their business, they showed no sign of hearing. Disappointed, she concluded that the opening was too small and she was too high. She looked for where the ravens waited and was happy three were there. Seeing the large tunnel for the foxes, she thought of Runagar approaching her on one, a sparkle in his eye, poise in his manner. Glancing at her gown, she saw it for the first time since getting lost. "It's moist and frayed," she thought, "torn by rock, a far cry from when I put it on." To her right was the waterfall, tumbling gently and gracefully, or so it appeared, into the cave below. What she had hoped for was fact. The water she fell into and had been moving next to formed the cave's waterfall. "That water's going where I wish to," she thought. "It found a way out of this dungeon, so will I." She forced herself away from the light and back into blackness. She had work to do, and she scrambled in search of a larger opening. Moving along the craggy wall, investigating every nook and cranny, she found no chink of light. Soon she was by the river, where it gushed wildly through the rock. A mild glow from the cave came through the water, and through a meager space around the torrent's upper border. Approaching with caution, she studied it carefully. There was no room, even for a Kirin, to squeeze between the stream of water and the stony encircling rim. "I'll find another route," she told the water, "but if I don't, I might return and join you." Quietly staring at the water, she wondered what would happen if she entered it. She envisioned herself gushing forth, falling peacefully, splashing into the pool below, then stepping out unscathed to the delight and applause of passing Shillitoes. But she knew this was only a fond dream. Her heiress was too fragile for such a buffeting. Returning to the light, she placed her mouth to the opening and shouted as loudly as she could, "I am here, above you! Answer me! I am Deliani of the Yorl clan!" She looked down. They were paying no attention. None had heard, as she already knew. "Where's Runagar now?" she wondered, remembering looking down on him on the trek to the cave, his coppery hair glistening and shining in the sunlight. "And those dark eyes, Could they find me here, as they seemed to while I flew above him? At least one of my questions is answered, she thought. Shillitoes wouldn't be wandering about at night. It must be daytime. But what day? How many days have I been gone? She returned to the river and studied it, watching swell after swell surge through, and came to an agonizing decision. Should I exhaust all other possibilities, I will take my chances with the water. She thought of Manet. If I go through with that plan, what will become of her? I don't know, but I wish to be with her again. She turned and headed back toward the precipice. She walked along the wider path first, then came to where it tapered. Moving onto the slender ledge, she advanced cautiously. Anticipating the defect, she stepped across and eventually made it all the way back, where Manet greeted her joyously. As De Liani stroked and praised the great bird for her diligence, the totality of their confinement came into painful focus. The Kirin threw her arms around the raven's neck, embracing an eidolon for the first time since childhood. She caressed and patted the bird until both were partially relieved. Then, allowing herself to slide down the wall to the clammy floor, she reclined, her back against moist stone, wanting to think of nothing. Suddenly, something cold grasped her wrist, hoisted her off the ground, and dragged her away down the tunnel. Chapter 41. Departing the queen, Speckerin made his way down the wall toward the Farinan. Presuming De Liani was awake by now, he wanted to tell her about Runagar's uncanny abilities and discuss his joining the quest.
I'm not eager, he thought, to take on a stranger, but his magic voice might prove valuable. Lenara said she could enhance it, extend the range over which it can be heard. Teach him how to use it to persuade and influence, and, amazingly, to imitate any living thing, bird, beast, Kirin, or human. It's almost too much to believe.
Arriving at the Farinan, he stepped inside and gazed at Tali.
She hasn't stirred, he thought. I hope the essence hasn't been given.
Glancing about, he saw no one. Surprised De Liani wasn't there, he went to the rear of the cavern, where Lydor and two helpers were bending over peering at a low portion of the distillation apparatus. So engrossed were they that no one greeted Speckerin or seemed to notice him. The machine, hushed compared to yesterday, was purring. He leaned forward to see what they were looking at, but couldn't fathom the device's intricacies. He cleared his throat. An attendant glanced at him, a grave look on his face, then turned back to the machine. Lydor spoke.
That's the extent of it.
What's happening? Asked Speckerin nervously. The Farinor turned and spoke with a severe tone in his usually melodious voice.
The distillation is complete. We have product, but it's unfortunately questionable.
He turned away.
Questionable?
Viable in quality, scant in amount. We had very little sap to work with. We've been waiting to see whether more essence was forthcoming. It appears not. The Barwood Grove has flowered, and procuring further sap is impossible.
He looked at Speckerin.
The traditional mode of administration is through the mouth, inducing swallowing. We haven't enough for that. But there is an alternative.
What?
Lydor turned to the machine and pointed to one of its lower lobes.
Look carefully at this crystal receptacle. You will see our product.
Moving closer, Speckerin peered through the wall of a square, transparent container at a tiny, gleaming droplet quivering at the tip of a glass tube. Teardrop-shaped, opaque and silver, it appeared to be liquid, without enough mass to fall. It looked like a miniature jewel.
"This is all?"
he asked.
"And the color, is it normal or does it come from the silver vial?"
"Essence is a dense liquid, always silver, and yes, what you see is the total result."
"Is it enough?"
Lydor ignored the question.
"We have never given it in this fashion, but ancient teachings hold that application of essence to an eyelid's inner surface might result in absorption into blood vessels."
He unlatched a small door on the side of the transparent compartment, housing the Gem of Hope for Tali.
"What I am about to do," he said, "must be done with utmost care, or we lose what we have."
Working through the door with one hand, he maneuvered a small crystalline flask into position under the precariously quivering droplet. Then, using a motion as deft as Speckerin had seen, with his middle finger he flicked the droplet off its moorings, and it fell into the new receptacle.
"We'll transport this to your lass," he said, "and be optimistic it will work."
Carrying the flask, he left the machine, bench, and ventilation shaft, and strode to the front of the Farrenen, Speckerin and the two assistants following. Except for slow, rhythmic breathing, Tali was motionless. Lydor glanced at an assistant.
"Draw open her right eye's lower lid."
The helper moved to her side and did, exposing a pink, moist surface. The Farrenor kneeled at the bedside, rotated the flask slowly until it was upside down, then gave it a slight tap. He stood up abruptly.
"It is done," he announced with a flourish, handing the receptacle to the second attendant.
The first released the eyelid and moved away.
"What's done?" wondered Speckerin, gazing down at Tali. "If anything fell from that flask, I didn't see it. How can he be so sure the droplet has gone and found its mark?"
Lydor and his helpers strode toward the work area, Speckerin staring after the one with the container, wanting to follow and examine it, but realizing that would be an affront to the Farrenor.
"I can only trust it was done properly," he told himself.
But then he changed his mind. After all, this was a matter of life and death, and he went to the back of the cavern. It was too late. The helper was rinsing the flask with water.
"All we can do is wait," thought Speckerin, returning to Tali, far from confident about what had transpired.
Observing the unconscious girl, he craved his friend's company. Just then, Hutt stepped through the entrance, patting the pruning knife in his belt.
"I have this back. Lindor just gave it to me. How's Tali?"
"I'm very glad you're here, little one," said the magician, overlooking his recent annoyance with the lad. "She was just given the essence." "At least I hope so," he thought. "We'll all be here when she awakens."
He remembered Deliani.
"She's missing this. Why has she slept so long? She's certainly had enough rest by now. I'll waken her."
Starting through the entrance, he glanced back at Tali and was torn between staying here and getting Deliani.
"Where are you going?" asked Lydor. "So soon after the essence was given."
"To get Deliani," said the old magician.
"Your place is here," said the Farrenor quietly. "Reignition of your girl's spirit might occur any time, though we know not precisely when. An assistant will go for your woman."
He spoke to his aides, and one was quickly off. Hutt was sitting on the floor next to Tali. Kneeling down beside him, Speckerin saw no change in her.
"Give her time," said Lydor.
Soon, her right eyelid flickered, the eye into which the droplet had presumably been placed. Speckerin watched attentively, reining in any excitement, but allowing himself hope and imagining the four voyagers' reunion. Some had gone their separate ways, but they would soon be back together. Hutt turned to him, a twinkle in his eye.
"Some day, when this is all over,
I might ask Tali to help me find someone just like her. She owes me, you know. She fell and I fetched Barwood sap to save her."
"It hasn't saved her yet," said the magician. "But you must never trifle with her about something not her fault, occurring when she was in so miserable a state over Jilin, Granums, Volodons, the entire mission."
He turned his attention back to her early and reassuring stirrings, slight movements of arms and legs, which seemed more perceptible and frequent all the while. Oblivious to anything around him, at times he was cheerful and optimistic, at others reflective. His thoughts were interrupted when the Feranor's assistant returned. Standing behind Speckerin, he delivered a report in the local dialect. Lyodor touched Speckerin's shoulder and spoke Ruvan.
"My aide has a surprising message."
Speckerin stood up quickly and stared at the messenger.
"I went to her room," he said in Ruvan. "She wasn't there. I asked the attendants about her. No one has seen her since last night. Thinking she might be attending to your Eilon, I went to the tunnel housing the birds. There were only three. I asked everyone I met, and no one had seen the woman or knew of the missing Eilon."
"Not in her room?" thought Speckerin, perplexed. "A raven gone? How can it be?"
"Iliani is about, somewhere in the cave. She found something unique to explore or someone fascinating to talk to, perhaps about the Fox Eilon. That would be just like her. What trials we've had! She's missing!"
"No," he chuckled, calming himself.
"Her? She's a rock, a pillar of stability through all our adventures and misadventures. She's never failed, never missed a beat. I'll go find her."
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirin's, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.